Okay, members, we'll call the Health and Human Services Reform Committee to order for today. And first, we need to, you have minutes in your packets, member, and we need to move approval of those minutes. Do I have a motion? Well, let me make sure I have the right ones in front of me.
Madam Chair, I move approval of minutes.
Representative Pearson moves approval of the minutes for January 13th. And January 14th. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. And the minutes are approved. Next, members, we are going to do just a brief introduction of committee staff for just so everybody knows kind of who's around the table. So I'll just run through the names, and if you want to just briefly raise your hand, wave to the committee so everybody knows who you are, that would be great. We have Rachel Stuckey, the committee administrator. Rachel Buckles, the committee administrative legislative assistant. The GOP researcher, Heather Kirschbaum. The DFL researcher, Leah Montgomery. And then we have nonpartisan House researchers Randy Chun, and they're probably not all in here today, actually. I guess the only one, just because it's what she covers, is Lynn Aves, is who we have here today. So, okay, so with that, members, today we are going over the governor's task force recommendations for child protective services. We have a few different members of the task force here, as well as members from the department, to kind of run through what has been going on in child protection services and the task force recommendations going forward. So we're going to kick it off here with Commissioner Koppel. You want to introduce yourself and begin with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. Commissioner Jessen should be here probably in the next 15 minutes to half hour to take my place and continue the conversation, but I will kick off the introduction of what we're going to testify about today. As I go along, anytime you have questions, please feel free during my introduction. Then, after I'm done giving you the overview and why this report happened and what is basically the thrust of the report, we will hear from members from each of the work groups. There were three work groups that were established in this task force, and each of the work groups has specific recommendations. And then those specific recommendations have some of them were taken and will be have been put into legislation, and you will be hearing that legislation, I think, later this week, tomorrow, not even later this week. That's where it's at right now. Let me back up and start out. I think up here showing. Yes, good. Is a picture of our of the front end child protection flow chart. And I want to start with this picture because I think it's a good reference point as we talk about child protection and the issues that we're facing, the challenges that we're facing, and what the report is looking at. This kind of stems from this chart. And where you see on the front end the call received by the county or tribe, and then the screening decision, that is where a tremendous amount of the conversation has been. In other words, when a call comes in, what happens? Is it screened out? Is there action taken? Further action taken? Is there a follow-up? And then the second part, as you see the next step on the PATH decision, is there going to be an investigation because there's a danger, imminent harm to the child, or is there going to be the family assessment model, which would say we will go in and look at the family and the needs of that family and put them on some type of an assessment, do an assessment and then see what particular behaviors or services or activities could be undertaken for that family to improve and for the situation for that child to improve. that has been the discussion of the task force, is really looking at what's happened in this area, why obviously the tragic deaths of some children in the child welfare system has stemmed this, but we're really talking about thousands of children in a system, and we were looking at the at it as a system rather than just those narrow views of what happened to those children. So the next slide I think I'll go to is the reports by maltreatment type. In the reports of maltreatment type, you can see neglect is by far the largest. Physical abuse, sexual abuse, mental injury, and medical neglect. And under each one, you can see which ones had family assessment as a decision as the pathway for treating that family, and the lighter color is family investigation. So just for instance, the third over, as you can see, the sexual abuse, almost all of the time that should be a family investigation. So that's something that jumped out at us and jumped out at the work of the task force right away, was we should never be looking at that in a family assessment model. That should be an investigation. That's being corrected. There are some things that we can do through guidelines and bulletins that but these are the things that again, that's just an example. I don't want to dwell on it, but just an example of something that caught us. Next slide, child maltreatment reports by response category. So this is the response to child maltreatment. So once a pathway is chosen, in other words, the call comes in, it is screened in. It's not screened out, screened in, and then it goes to a decision point. Family assessment, family investigation, or facility investigation in the case if it's a facility versus a family. But as you can see, the family assessment gone from 6,000 up to 14,000, and the family investigation from 10,000 to 5,000. I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of this in a second as to why that's occurring, but I just wanted to kind of go through these slides to give you this picture first. Incidents per 1,000 by race, ethnicity, and maltreatment type. You can see a disproportionately African American and American Indian, many times that of white, as well as Asian Pacific Islanders are quite low, but the American Indian and African American families have a large disproportionate number. And that will show up in the next slide as well. Children in out-of-home care per 1,000. Very high number American Indian, African American. Pretty consistent pattern. In fact, Native American going up. So at the same time, so these are the factors. So I'm gonna stop with the slides for a second and now come back to just some casual conversation, which is these are the kinds of data that you look at and you can draw a conclusion by any one of those pages, any one of those graphs. What the task force and what the child welfare system is trying to do and should do, and we, and I can promise that from the department vantage point, what we will do is we want to make sure minimally in Minnesota that every child is safe. And when a child enters a child welfare system, that they either remain safe, get to safety, but also are on a course of well-being where they're going to develop and have a better chance at moving forward. Now, that can happen inside a family that's in the child welfare system. That can happen in a placement. But it's not happening enough today. So if children aren't thriving in these situations, if we're not able to move families forward or move the child forward and minimally get them to safety, because that's what you read about. But I don't think that's a very satisfactory goal. I think we have to have a well-being protocol as well, that we're looking at healthy development of a child. So that's the goal of the child welfare system. And when the if we went back to the 1990s, I was at the Children's Defense Fund in the late 90s, and the child welfare system at that time was very focused on going in. There was much more of a enforcement protocol. Go into a family, something's wrong, fix it, we'll be back. And if it's not fixed, there's a placement. In the late 90s, what we looked at, Missouri had a model called multiple response, where you could go into a family and say, you know, if you've got a problem here, if there's, especially because the majority of the cases, remember, are neglect. So you could have a child at home, unsupervised, because they're not in child care, school's out, maybe they're 6 years old, they're home early, and they're unsupervised. Child care could be a response to that. If it's a hunger issue, nutrition issue, you know, we have many nutrition programs. So we tried to put that worker in a position where they could do a response to the problem. So it wasn't just fix it. It was actually, and there are some things that could help you here. And so that they became a facilitator. And we also wanted to try to provide, put that worker in a different light than just the enforcement light when they walked in the door of a home. So over time, that became called, it was multiple response was the initial, then it became alternative response, and now it's called family assessment. None of which are, they're just terms. So the family assessment model has been And even in some of this discussion, and you'll see when we get to the legislation, had become the preferred model. In many ways, it made a lot of sense, because you wanted to give the family, and I believe that, you know, that a child's first chance and best chance is in their family, and you want that family to succeed, you want the child to succeed. And these were some of the tools engaged in this family assessment model, was toward that end. We wanted to get at the high out-of-home placements of African-American and Native American families disproportionately. Was there some better cultural training that could be done? Is there better cultural training that could be done to improve that? Because obviously we've got a disproportionate number, but we also have, and this is an interesting thing in child welfare, it's a microcosm of society in that we have a disproportionate number of Native American, African American families in poverty. And when you're in poverty, if you look at the statistics, you're overrepresented in the child welfare system. So in some ways, the child welfare system is a match point for some of our other disparities. It plays out in the child welfare system, but it exists many places. So it isn't like we can just cure this issue right here narrowly and it's going to go away. We have to look broadly and have a context for the work that we're doing.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. We just have a brief question from Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Koppel, on the decision tree that you show in that one slide, I just have a couple questions. The first one is, you know, when you discuss the pathway chosen, my first question is, what would constitute or qualify the decision to be no? What criteria are they? Is it a process-driven qualification, or is it subjective to the screener that takes the call? Madam Chair?
Commissioner Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, let me back up for a second and answer your question. It's a county-administered system, state-supervised, county-administered. So we have 87 child welfare systems in Minnesota, which I think is telling you where my, how I'm going to answer your question. It is, there are protocols that can be followed. Are they consistently followed in every county? Is the person answering that phone in every county trained as well as the previous? The answer is there is variety and there is disparity among counties and how they respond. So you do have different responses in different counties. How different, we don't know. You know, you can track data, but even that doesn't necessarily tell you whether decisions were right or wrong. So one of the challenges of this system is it is a county-based system, and we do need stronger state supervision. This is all going to come out in the discussion that we will have, and I don't want to jump into the recommendations that will be forthcoming that we'll talk about. I'm just trying to, but that's a great question for backdrop is, yes, it's a disparate system right now. There are some really good practices out there, and there are some practices not so good. It's also a county finance system. 50% of the cost of this system is at the county level. About 30% is federal, and a little less than 20% is state. So from a percentage perspective, we're, I believe, 49th out of 50 states in the percent of money we have in the child welfare system. It's very much a county-driven system because they're paying the money. And so I think part of our challenge is to look at where we have not, where we need to become stronger in supervision with established protocols, best practices, better data to manage, to give feedback, so that the person making those decisions has the best possible information. That's going to come out a little bit in some of the discussion this afternoon.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on that, Mr. Koppelman, and maybe I'm jumping the gun on this, but to the extent that you can relay or respond to this, then if the screening, if you screen a call out, and so it goes somewhere, is there any type of debrief on that call by the group, or what measure of follow-up is made on behalf of that call to find out if there's any subsequent change in the decision on behalf of the screener or on the family that made the call?
Commissioner Koppel.
And you can throw a lifeline if you want.
Did I have that look in my eye?
Yes, you did.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Albright. I think I will ask one of our staff to come down and Jamie Sorensen, who's our acting director, division director for.
Thank you, Mr. Koppel.
If you could just introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, Jamie Sorensen, acting director with the Child Safety and Permanency Division. And Madam Chair. In terms of counties and screening decisions, as Assistant Commissioner Koppel explained, there's variety in terms of how counties do this work. There are counties that do this work in a multidisciplinary team manner where the screening is done by either a group of professionals within the county system. In some instances, they'll bring in a law enforcement professional to be part of that decision. I think in terms of the work, what we're striving for is more uniformity in terms of how that practice is done, the methodology, and then also the criteria that counties use in making those decisions. There are requirements to cross-report referrals to law enforcement, and so that's one element that flows from the screening decision. Another option is if a referral is not receiving the attention through family investigation or family assessment, it can be referred to a voluntary program called Parent Support Outreach, and that program can network families and children to a variety of programs and services to address any issues that resulted in being brought to the attention of the department.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Mr. Sorensen, just to follow up, is there a record kept on every call that's made, whether it's screened in? Well, obviously, if it's screened in, there is, but if it's screened out, is there a record kept for a certain amount of time, regardless of it being screened out or not?
Madam Chair, that is actually a new law that came into effect that requires counties to document certain elements of each report received and the screening rationale for those reports. And those reports then are now housed in what's called the Social Service Information System. One of the possible recommendations coming forth from the task force is to extend the retention of those for a period of 5 years.
Representative Mulry, do you have a comment to that point?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I think it should be brought out in I'm on that task force subcommittee on screening, and we found that even despite the law saying that they had a cross report to law enforcement, a lot of the time they weren't doing that. A second point I think is important. We found that a lot of the time, and we're going to have, we haven't decided finally on what to recommend, but even mandated reporters were not hearing back if there was any follow-through in some cases. In fact, even doctors who had referred it were not getting it back. So there's going to be a recommendation from our subcommittee as to exactly what needs to be reported, but we're thinking that for sure mandated reporters who have also some continuing influence or dealing with the child should at the minimum find out about it. I think those are two important things with regard to your question, and I can't remember the rest of your question.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Koppel.
If I could, I would prefer that we, that's going to be discussed by in our recommendations today, and so I rather just for, and I'll get out of the way here as soon as I need to, but I'd rather us wait to get into the specific where we're going to go as opposed to, you know, what some of the problems are or questions about how does it work, because Representative Mulry is saying we do have some specific things we are addressing in that regard, but I'd rather have the other testifiers come forward to have done the work and tell you about some of those recommendations.
Thank you for that. We have a couple other questions. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner Koppel, you break out the medical neglect. What portion of those are cultural, religious, or, you know, basically a difference in opinion of treatment?
Commissioner Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I'm not sure if we have those numbers, but I know we don't have them here. I would have to go back and check and see if we have that kind of breakout.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just thought since Assistant Commissioner Koppel had brought up, you know, the differences between counties and how half the funding is county provided, that's part of, I think, what we're going to have to wrestle with if we want a uniform system, because this is one of the areas that was cut tremendously over the deficit years. And it's, you know, the end result is just like we around the table might differ in our ability and willingness to raise taxes. So do the 87 county boards. And some of them are more willing to step up and raise property taxes to replace lost family preservation aid, lost social service aid, and things like that than others. And so I think that, you know, if we're going to work towards a uniform system, it's not just about protocols, but it's making sure that every county has the resources to respond appropriately. As we move forward.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have a question for Commissioner Koppel, more on the system as it is piece, so that you can get done with that. One of the things I have learned recently is that when a family is offered, when there's a family assessment and the family is offered services, that it's totally voluntary whether they take the services or not. And so I'm looking at the flow chart. First of all, where does that come in, is that between family assessment and the decision of whether child protective services are needed, so that you offer services, see whether there's any uptake, any process, and then you decide on child protective, or does it go after that? And I'm just wondering about that. Am I right that it's totally voluntary, or does it sometimes have teeth in it in that on that track?
Commissioner Koppel. Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, that is correct. It is voluntary. Those services are offered, and they are voluntary. That is, if you look at the after family assessment, that box, the next box, child protective services needed, that's where that occurs.
So before,
Representative Liebling.
Sorry, Madam Chair, but between those two boxes, so you offer those services, see whether the family takes advantage of that before you decide, so you're holding on to the case to then decide based on their response whether you need to jump to the other track?
Commissioner Koppel.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, yes.
Okay, thank you.
And Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I want to kind of to like respond to the screening out part of this flowchart. And, you know, I think in 2013 or 2014, we passed some legislation to make the PSOP, the Family, the Parent Support Outreach Program, statewide, because we found that, you know, so often when parents are being screened out, they could be on the verge of neglect or maltreatment or abuse. But if you offer them service, that it can have a great impact on the child well-being. And so we put some funding towards that, but I think one of the issues with that, when we talk about the disproportionate numbers of African Americans and Native Americans in the system, is that when you've been weeded out when you've been screened out, and someone from the county says, I want to offer you services, you know, a family is suspicious of that. You know, they don't often trust the county or believe that you're not trying to come in and take the children out of the homes. And so the goal was to create some family support service outreach that was in the community where families can connect to an organization or a church or a body that they trust, that they have a relationship with, but that they trust, that they're coming from a good place if I want to help you. But we seem to not have enough of those community organizations that can offer that type of support for families. Is that correct?
Commissioner Koppel.
That is culturally appropriate for the communities.
Commissioner Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, I don't know if we could speak, you know, you'd have to look county by county at the resources available. Certainly, there are counties that are less able to provide much of that, and there are other counties that can do work at providing it. So it does vary. I think one thing to keep in mind throughout these conversations, and actually, Representative Moran, if you would wait, and this will be part of a recommendation discussion that I think you'll have more discussion around in a minute here. I'm going to wrap up. But I think nothing works if it isn't implemented correctly. You know, if we were going to have alternative responses for families to help them become stable and gain a solid footing, whether it be nutrition or housing or safety issues, those services have to be there. If they're not there, if there's waiting lists, if they're not really programs, then they're not really there. So we have to look at it both ways. That we're going. Whatever it is we do, we have to be realistic and know that that's available. Then a lot of these other questions about the voluntary nature of the services and you know, some of these other questions that have been raised are all going to be part of this discussion in a minute when the task force or when our work groups present, as well as when you debate the bill tomorrow. So I think with that, if you would permit me, I'm kind of going in reverse order today, but I was just going to go back to say that this task force, this governor's task force on the protection of children, I believe you have a list of task force members, and they're from all over the state. They're representatives of counties as well as advocates. We try to get the broadest points of view. We had several legislators on. Representative Cresha, Representative Mullery were on from the House, and Senator Rosen and Senator Sharon were on in the Senate. But the full list, I believe, you have. And again, I think the key piece is that the goal of this task force was the safety of children and to put the child first in the discussion, so that when we're trying to figure out what's the best system, that the child should be our utmost priority, and the safety and well-being of that child should be our utmost priority. So that was, again, just some of the background of the task force when it did its work. If there aren't any more questions, I would move.
We have one more question, and then we will move on to the presenters for the work groups. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to answer part of Representative Liebling's question. We did have testimony on your specific question. Some counties do if it's a voluntary system. Some, if it isn't working and they're satisfied, they then shift it into the other system where they go through the requirements of the court. Some counties don't do that, so that's another issue.
Thank you, Representative Mullery. Okay, well, with that, if you have concluded, Commissioner Koppel, we have Kathy Johnson here. As long as I haven't seen Commissioner Justin walk in, have I? No. Okay. I know she's going to be making it over here, and we'll probably let her come to the table when she gets in here. But we have Kathy Johnson, Director of Kitson County Social Services, and the lead on the Training and Supervision of Practice Work Group. So you just introduce yourself and begin with your presentation.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Kathy Johnson. I'm the Director of Kitson County Social Services. I'm also a granddaughter of a Danish immigrant who proudly served in the Minnesota House of Representatives from 1953 to 1958. He taught his grandchildren to love this country and this state. I am therefore truly honored to appear before you today. My home county of Kitson is the northwest corner of Minnesota and is approximately 4,500 residents scattered across 1,100 square miles. As a comparison, Hennepin County has close to 1.2 million residents occupying 607 square miles. Thus, Hennepin has 267 times more residents than Kitson in half the space. It might appear that Hennepin and Kitson counties may not have much in common, yet we are both proud counties of Minnesota who have the duty to serve our residents through our programming, with the most important one being the protection of our youngest residents from abuse and neglect. We understand the daunting task this committee has in trying to set policies and reforms that will be effective and fit the needs of all Minnesota counties and tribes. I am honored to have been appointed by Governor Dayton to serve on the task force for the protection of children, and I am also honored to serve as the chair of the task force work group of training and supervision of practice. Our work group has been given four charges. We are to critique and deliberate on these charges as to whether or not they are currently being adequately met in the present child protection system. Our first charge is to review the qualifications of child protection staff. Our group is reviewing the process for qualifying staff through the merit system, which is used by the majority of counties for its hiring process. Of the 19 counties that do not use the merit system, their procedures must be reviewed by the merit system and deemed to be adequate in meeting the necessary procedures for qualifying candidates for county social work positions. We therefore are focusing on just the merit system candidate qualifying process to determine its adequacy. This charge has also brought up the discussion of county applicants being allowed to fill social work positions with educational backgrounds of social work or related degrees. I believe you are familiar with this discussion as per the licensing of social workers and the county's fears of diminishing the pool of applicants that is already scarce in many areas of the state, especially the more rural counties. We are deliberating this and we'll have a recommendation at the end for our final recommendations. Our second charge is to review the workforce challenges and opportunities of our present child protection system. We have discussed the difficulty in attracting candidates to the far reaches of the state and ways we could address this issue. We are likely to recommend that the state implement a student loan forgiveness program for social workers, with a priority being given to candidates who would choose to work in the state's rural areas. We are also assessing the current workload and caseload size of child protection workers. We have noted that while the legislature has put in statute the maximum caseload for other social service program areas, there has not been a specific child protection caseload size stated in current statute. Social workers who have reported to the task force and our work group have repeatedly stated that they do not have enough time to meet the needs of their families, to complete their paperwork, or to attend workshops and trainings. Our work group is considering recommending that a maximum child protection caseload be assigned. We are working with counties and also the department to look at what to figure out a good recommendation for that caseload size. Our third charge is to look at the training adequacy of child protection workers in the present system. Currently, our first two of our four recommendations were for training. Our work group recommended that the child protection training for social workers be taken. Presently, there's a child welfare program that's over a six-week period that we are looking to take the child protection training out of that training and just focus on training child protection workers so that can be done quickly and hopefully frequently. We have also noted that there is no mandate for child protection supervisors to have any training, and we are likely to require that the legislature require training for child protection supervisors. Our work group also continues to discuss the adequacy of the current mandated reporter training. We are considering recommending to the legislature that they ask various licensing boards to add the requirement of mandated reporter training certification at license renewal. Our fourth and final charge is to review the adequacy of program supervision and oversight. Currently, the county's child protection programs are being audited in five separate review processes. These include the Child and Family Services Review, the monthly reviews of county screening decisions, the Human Services Performance Management System, and County Citizen Review Panels, and the Child Mortality Review Team. We are deliberating on the adequacy of these reviews and are looking at ways we may strengthen and improve their effectiveness. Our work group is also looking at recommending the creation of a new outside independent review of child protection practices. We are reviewing other such practices from other programs and states, and we'll have a recommendation by March. As you know, with all of these recommendations that have come out of the task force to date and more that will be coming, all of this depends on funding that will be available. And we're hoping that with the advent of the governor's budget coming out this week, I believe, next week, and also with the deliberations of the legislature, that funding of this important improvement to our child protection system will be of utmost importance to everybody involved. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, are there any questions for this testifier? Okay, thank you so much for your presentation. We next have Michelle Zender-Fisher, Nicollet County Attorney and member of the Screening and Transparency Work Group. You could introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Michelle Zender-Fisher. I'm Nicollet County Attorney. I've served in that position since the fall of 2011, and prior to that, I served as the Assistant Nicollet County Attorney and Chief Deputy Nicollet County Attorney since 1995. And I provide that information to give this group understanding that since 1995, I have been doing county child protection work as an assistant county attorney, and my passion and belief is that child protection work in the county attorney's office and in counties provides has the very real impact on the current lives of children and their families, as well as for their futures and that of our communities. I was honored to be appointed by the governor to serve in this very important task force, and I thank you for this opportunity to present to you our initial recommendations. I do become before you as a task force member and not at this point as a representative of the County Attorneys Association, where I also serve on the board of directors. As indicated, I am a member of the work group on screening and transparency. And our work is still ongoing. We did make some preliminary recommendations. And our work group focuses on that flow chart that was presented earlier. At the very beginning of the process, when a report of child protection concern is received, to kind of review and highlight, the response to a child protection report process can kind of be broken into three main components. The first is what cases or reports are received into the system to be evaluated. The second is how is the system going to respond to that report, that is whether there's a family investigation or a family assessment. And the final response is what response is that agency going to take once the investigation or family assessment is completed in terms of services and ongoing involvement with the family. Our group looks at that very first stage of the proceeding. In making a summary of the recommendations that this work group put forth, I place them into three broad categories. The first is ensuring that adequate information is considered and available for making a proper screening. The second is the propriety of how screening decisions are made. And finally is looking at the internal system, the information system, the SSIS system, and public accountability for the decisions that are made in the screening process. And as I indicated earlier, our work is not yet completed, and we are still refining some of the recommendations as we continue to receive information and hear testimony and have further discussions in our work group. Overall, of all the broad recommendations this work group provided in recommendations, our first and foremost emphasis is on child safety and to place the child first in response to a maltreatment concern. This guiding principle served as the basis for recommendation 2 in the report to the governor, that the policy statement of 626-556, which is the mandated reporter statute, should be revised to reflect that child safety is of paramount concern. Currently, the statute refers to family first, or emphasis on family rather than the child. It was the feeling of the work group that the introduction and the preamble to 626-556 should mirror that of Chapter 260C, which are the statutes that govern child protection actions, to look at the best interests of the child as well as the safety of the child. The first category is the adequacy of information that is received to make a screening decision. The first recommendation, number one, is that the task force recommends removing the language in statute that precludes consideration of a prior screened out report. If the best decision is to be made in response to a report of a child maltreatment concern, the screening process should consider all available information, and that should include prior screened out reports. Prior history of a family can be a very important consideration in looking at the information in a current report. Prior history can also provide information that may be lacking in a current report that would result in that report being screened in. In hearing testimony in this matter, both as a work group as well as the whole task force, it seemed that just about everyone that came before either group, their first recommendation was to remove the language regarding not considering past screened out reports. The second under this broad category of adequacy of information relates to number 7 of the task force recommendation, which is to allow screeners to seek some additional collateral information when making screening decisions. This is a topic that we continue to have considerable discussion on. As it is, the statute currently is silent, but the screening guidelines were amended in 2012 to prohibit any collateral information from being collected prior to a report being screened in and assigned for family assessment or family investigation. The goal is to really look at, if there's a piece missing, can a screener make a limited inquiry of another mandated reporter or another source of information, determine if a report should be screened in or screened out? And the extent of that gathering of additional collateral information, as I indicated, is something that we're having further discussion on. The next recommendation under adequacy of information relates to number 8 in the recommendation to the initial recommendations, and that is making changes to the information system that ensures accessibility across the system of maltreatment reports, including justifications made by other counties for screening decisions and other pertinent records across counties. This would include planning purposes of including tribal social service agency reports as well.
And Ms. Zender-Fisher, I'm just going to interrupt you for 1 second. Members, just so you know, we have new copies coming to us. You're missing a couple of recommendations on the back of this sheet. My apologies. But those will be here briefly, so just want to let you guys know. So sorry for the interruption. We do have one question from one of our members. Would you like to take that now or wait till the end of your presentation?
Madam Chair, I feel like I'm here to answer questions, so I'll take questions whenever. Thank you.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, Representative Mulry, there's also another place where you can see the recommendations. On this spreadsheet, the recommendations are delineated there also, so you'll be able to find what she's referencing. Representative Fisher had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have is in the initial screening processes as you're going through, there are a couple things that kind of came to my mind. I work at a homeless youth shelter in North Minneapolis, and we occasionally run into making reports. Do you folks take a look at, like, extenuating circumstances, or take a look at other things that might be going on? Say, is the youth already homeless as an indicator of what might be happening? And also some of the questions I have is a lot of times when dealing with the youth, it's very hard for them to, be able to build a relationship where they're able to get that information out. And sometimes the person they choose to disclose to may not always be the person that is doing the investigation. What are some of the things that you are looking at as you're doing your recommendations to try to address those issues?
Ms. Zender-Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I follow the question, how we respond to a report is based upon what information is received in that report. And I think that being able to consider past screened out reports might be very helpful to homeless youth. For example, if they're sometimes when we have abuse victims, they may disclose pieces. And so if you've got a teacher that's making a report and you might have a volunteer in a homeless shelter that's making a report and it relates to the same youth, maybe the information on from one is not sufficient, but if we can combine that information, we can better serve that youth to respond to the report from the youth. We have had some presentation about how do we respond to older children in the system, and it is a very complicated response because older children have very different needs than our younger children, and how we respond to them can be very different, and our statute doesn't allow us to respond differently. For example, leaving an older child residing with a non-family member, if it's a safe environment, our current statute doesn't necessarily allow us to say that that's going to be acceptable unless that person, for example, becomes licensed as a foster care provider. So it's a very challenging segment of the population to respond to in the child protection, child maltreatment response.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. That was one of the questions. Is I also had a further question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Was in the area of age. Is it feels at times that as youth are a little bit older, they sometimes feel like they're falling through the system because of the age it's in. And having gone through reports, it seems as we start hitting that 16, 17-year-old range, it seems like it's you know, the reports get made, and it's like we feel nothing ever happens, even though we're seeing some very nasty things occurring. How do you feel there's a better way to try to get at that with your recommendations so that there can be better outcomes, but particularly when it seems that, to me, when you're dealing with someone who's already homeless, there's already neglect happening in that kind of instance?
Ms. Zender Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Fisher, that is one topic area that we are going to continue to have discussion on in our work group. I don't know that I have a representative answer from the work group other than recognizing that the system perhaps currently is not responding adequately to older youth. So we are recognizing it as a deficit in how we are responding, and certainly recognizing that 16 and 17-year-olds are entitled to as much protection as our younger children. I think there may need to be greater look at changes in the statute to allow us to respond better to their needs and issues.
And I have just a brief follow-up question, a little bit different note, but as we look at the issue of family assessment and understanding the recommendations coming to kind of take some of the preferential treatment off of that method and prioritizing child safety, I think there's a little bit of value in looking back to just figure out how we got here. And I don't know if you'd be able to answer this question, but what assessment maybe did your work group do in terms of the particular issue of the sexual abuse cases, which kind of, you know, got a lot of the attention of this issue and the 384 that were put into family assessment? From your experience in the work group, could you walk us through maybe how did that happen? How did sexual abuse cases get put into that kind of that trajectory when they were never meant to? What was the thinking of the workers in that case that kind of got us off track in those situations?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't want to steal Dr. Hudson's thunder in terms of looking at family assessment, but we did try to look at that, and I think that's one of the recommendations that's coming out of this work group, is that we need to better document the reasons why decisions are made about whether it goes to family assessment or family investigation, because when we went back, the reasons why wasn't always clear. I know that anecdotally we were told in some that it appeared when the report came in that it was a case of sexual abuse, but when there was an initial investigation, then it appeared as though perhaps it was no longer sexual abuse, and then it was switched to maybe there was a different issue, a supervision issue with younger children, for example, then it switched to a family assessment. And I think that's another recommendation, is before a screening tracked changes made, that there perhaps should be some discussion with the county attorney's office about whether there that decision should be made, if it is to be made at all.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to your suggestion that the law or the statute be changed to allow for accessibility to prior screen or calls made, and maybe walk us through why that is the way it is currently. And I'm wondering if it's more of a legal data privacy issue, or is it more of a refraining from prejudicial treatment for, you know, you get so many calls, you finally act, and maybe there's nothing wrong there anyway, but it almost prejudices you towards acting in such a way. And if it's of a legal nature, are we still running up against the obstacle of data privacy provisions between the various functions of where that information is housed?
Ms. Zender Fisher.
Thank you. In terms of the data privacy, I don't think it's a data practices issue, because social services has that information in their system, and that's one of the recommendations, is to ensure that all the information on a family is available in making a screening decision. My limited understanding in terms of where the recommendation came from last year about not considering prior screened out reports was a concern of racial disparity. That's the response we've gotten when we asked that question of what was the motivating factor, and that is that children of color come to the attention of the system more frequently, and if they come to the attention more frequently, they may have more reports. And as you indicated, those greater reports may result in a decision to screen in a case that shouldn't be screened in. What I would say to that is the flip concern is that we're not considering enough reports for children who do meet criteria. And the best example I can give is any opportunity that I have to present to mandated reporters is, as a mandated reporter, it's not your job to make a decision about whether abuse is happening or maltreatment or neglect is happening. Your obligation under the law is if you have a reason to believe, you need to make that report. And your report may be the last piece of information the agency needs to provide protection to a child. So as in the example that I provided earlier, a teacher might have a piece of the puzzle, a daycare provider might have a piece of the puzzle, the neighbor might have a piece of the puzzle. And if you can put all of those pieces together, you can get a picture maybe of what's happening in that family. And if we can't consider prior screened out reports, we can't put those puzzle pieces together. So that's my response of, and the overwhelming response we've received from presenters is that we need that information to best serve children and families for safety.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions, but I'm going to ask them one at a time. What type of instance would be considered as maltreatment?
Maltreatment, there's a...
Ms. Zender Fisher.
Oh, I'm sorry. There are specific criteria under 626-556 of what could be maltreatment. It would be physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, medical neglect. It can be lack of supervision. It can be lack of food, clothing, shelter. Any type of traditional physical abuse, hitting, depending on the age of the child and whether injury is received. So there's a broad category that can fall into the arena of maltreatment.
Representative Moran.
Madam Chair, so it can be as maybe as huge as sexual abuse, but as simple, not that as simple as a child come to school with dirty clothes.
Ms. Zender Fisher.
Thank you. It could be as simple as a teacher reporting that the child is coming to school with dirty clothes. I don't know that would meet screening criteria to be screened as a child protection report without more than necessarily the condition of the child's clothing. It may be what I've seen is that the child is coming to school with clothing that's too small or it's below zero and the child is coming without a coat and the child has an odor because it appears they haven't bathed. So it's adding pieces to that besides the state of their clothing.
Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
And it could be those examples that you gave of smelly clothing, too small clothing, which would be considered as maltreatment. And so I'm just wondering, in doing the screening, what was the thought process of the group when you made recommendations to send all reports of maltreatment to law enforcement, regardless of whether the report is screened in or screened out?
Ms. Zender Fisher.
It is the feeling of the work group that is already, the cross-reporting is already required in statute. 626-556 states that if a report is received by law enforcement, it should be reported to social services, and if social services receives a report, it should be reported to law enforcement. And that, it's already there. Counties weren't doing it uniformly, and so the recommendation was to make sure that it's done on a uniform basis so that both agencies have knowledge, so that a decision by each of the agencies who have different responsibilities can make a decision of how to respond to the information, as well as allow them to work together. And I think that goes to one of the recommendations as well about that screening decisions can be best made by a multiple disciplinary response, and having voices of both can lead to a better response choice.
Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
So I was just wondering what would be the protocol for law enforcement when they receive that information of something as minute as small clothing or that's too small for a child, what would be the officer report or response to that?
Ms. Zenderfisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't believe that law enforcement, based upon anecdotal evidence, would respond to a report that a child has too small of clothing. I don't see that in practice occurring. Where I see law enforcement having a response may be if there's a report of physical abuse and injury, then they would want to be involved in that investigation to determine whether there's a violation of criminal statute as well. But in terms of the report of a child having too small of clothing, I don't see a law enforcement response to that report based upon anecdotal evidence.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
From your opinion, that could happen, but it also could happen that it could be many instances like that, or like a food in a home or a smelly child that a police officer may want to respond to that. I mean, they're open because they have the ability to do that, so is it a possibility? I mean, it could happen.
Ms. Zenderfisher.
Thank you. I suppose in theory it could happen that a police officer might respond. I note that sometimes the cross-reporting, there is information that law enforcement may have about somebody living in the home. If the child is coming to school with inadequate clothing or doesn't appear to bathe, and law enforcement have been called to that house because of known drug use, for example, that cross-report would allow law enforcement to share that information then with social services to give social services some additional information.
Okay, Madam Chair, one last question.
Representative Moran.
Have you ever known a child to be taken out of their home for those purposes, with not the other mitigating factors around drugs being in the home, but just because the child consistently came to school with small clothes, smelly clothes? You know, have you seen that happen within the system?
Ms. Zenderfisher.
Thank you. I've never known that to happen. For a child to be removed from the home, a law enforcement officer would have to make a decision that child is at risk of imminent harm. And if it's not being the result of a decision by law enforcement, then it would have to be by judicial order and information provided to the court, and there would have to be a court order provided to remove the child.
Thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm through this discussion and the earlier discussion by about data and privacy. Has the committee looked at, once you share, and some of the recommendations include transfer of screened and unscreened, you know, reports over to law enforcement? I'm familiar with, in our weeklies and dailies, law enforcement went to this a house on this block, etc., or this apartment complex. They're scrubbed of at least minor children's names. But do you pass over to a point where you're now making public some general information, which then could have, you know, effects to, you know, a neighborhood, a housing project, an apartment complex? And, you know, was there any look at the differences in how data is treated? Because I assume that in DHS, it's very non-public. But once you cross over that boundary into law enforcement, I believe that there's more of a social acceptance of general things and some facts being made public. So can you enlighten us on that type of discussion that maybe went on?
Ms. Zenderfisher.
Thank you. I won't sit before you and profess to be a data practices expert. What I can tell you generally is that information is treated the same regardless of the agency's hands that it is in. So if it is confidential information in social services hands, it should be confidential information in law enforcement's hands. Mm-hmm. Although if it transfers into, for example, a child, a physical abuse investigation, then it can become a criminal investigation, which could then result in disclosure in the course of law enforcement investigative data would be my my sitting here today response to that question, but I certainly would defer to others who have more expertise in the role of data practices.
Okay, Ms. Zender-Fisher, if you had some more of your... Representative Fisher has one more question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is kind of a follow-up on what Representative Moran was asking before. Is one of the things that kind of stuck in my mind is you said that courts will sometimes, the police or the courts will make decisions if children are going to be removed from the homes. Is there a summary, and I don't see it anywhere here, of what the reasons were when courts order people, youth being removed from the homes, children? How much is for sexual abuse? How much is for... and not being able to provide the resources, whether it's smelly clothes or those kind of, you hear what I'm getting at is, I'd like to be able to know what kind of information is along those lines.
Ms. Zender-Fisher.
Thank you. I am not aware of whether that data exists, and I guess I would direct that question. I don't know if DHS has that specific information about when, because once we get into the court ordering removal, we're already in a 260C action where there's been a decision made to file a child protection action and a request then made either in the course of that child protection case or initially to ask the court to order removal of a child. And then that can become a complicated analysis in the sense that if you've already got an existing case and the parent is failing to follow recommendations, then the removal may be that the parent isn't following recommendations of maintaining sobriety or providing to the child for the child's needs.
Okay, Ms. Zender-Fisher, I don't see any more questions at this point, so if you had more of your presentation to wrap up.
I will try to skim through the rest of the recommendations, talking about the propriety of how screening decisions are made. And we've already kind of talked about recommendation 3 and 5, which is really to make screening decisions in a team-based environment using a multidisciplinary approach whenever possible, and that input from law enforcement can strengthen decisions and should be encouraged, and that goes to the cross-reporting issues. Number 9 of the recommendations also is something that our group is continuing to have great discussion of, and that is the ability to release information to a mandated reporter who made the report, as well as to a mandated reporter who did not make the report but has an ongoing responsibility for the health, education, or welfare of the child affected by the data. I think this is driven by... the fact that some mandated reporters, despite statute that says they should receive the summary, are not getting a response back when they've made a maltreatment report about what happened to that report. And the discussion about how much additional information should be shared, for example, if a teacher didn't make the report, is there information that a teacher may need to have to help that child in response to a child protection report? But as I indicated, we are still looking at that issue, and certainly that will involve a significant study of the data practices statute to ensure that both pieces are changed to allow for sharing of information. The recommendations 10 and 11 of our of the recommendation initial recommendations relate to the screening guidelines. DHS put forth screening guidelines for counties. There was inconsistency amongst the counties about how those guidelines are utilized. It is recommended that the counties use screening guidelines as the floor, that consistent with 626-556, we can offer more protection to children in terms of cases that we're going to screen, but we certainly cannot go below the guidelines put forth in the screening guidelines. The other recommendation in 11 is to look at additional cases. There's some provisions in the screening guidelines that talk about if it's a mental and emotional harm report, for example, a strong emphasis on the need of a supporting statement from a psychologist or a therapist, and looking at additional reports from others not necessarily tied to a professional. 12 of the recommendations talks about the definition of physical abuse. Currently, the statute lists a number of actions that are done in anger or without regard to the safety of the child, and the recommendation is to remove that language to refer only to actions that are not reasonable or moderate, which includes, and then it goes on to list things as throwing, kicking, burning, all of which are actions that regardless of whether they're done in anger, without regard, are done in anger, they're not appropriate towards a child. Finally, the recommendations talk about the internal system and public accountability for the screening process, and that goes to the transparency piece that will have greater emphasis in our final recommendations. What we are looking at is ensuring that there is consistency in how reports are logged into the system to allow us to do a better analysis of what information is provided. For example, a report, a family is currently under assessment, and there's a second report received that is of the same exact nature that's currently investigated. Looking at screening that in as a duplicate report instead of a new report, or screening it out. Similarly, there is not consistency about if a case is referred to the wrong county and that county refers it to the child's home county. The report looks screened out in the county that was wrong for the report, but it might be screened in the county where the child actually resides. So ensuring greater consistency and ability to analyze data.
Ms. Vender-Fisher, just a question to that point, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On point number 12, you're requesting, or the suggestion is to remove language that to some extent removes or adds, in my opinion, maybe some ambiguity, not reasonable and moderate, and putting together somewhat of an exhaustive list of definitionals. But isn't it almost at your peril to do that, given the fact that you don't know who is going to be sitting on either side of the table, either being the arbiter of a decision against the person who is being investigated, or vice versa, based upon such things as cultural stigmas or patterns of habit, what might be appropriate or reasonable or moderate in the eyes of the parent, based upon their cultural upbringing, might be contrary to who's trying to discern what is reasonable and moderate. So aren't we almost adding greater ambiguity by going to that language as opposed to leaving it where it's at, based upon what Representative Moran, I thought, elaborated on?
Ms. Vender-Fisher.
Thank you. That actual discussion occurred in the committee or in the work group about what is the consequence of removing that language. I think that the majority of the discussion centered around the fact that this is the screening of what comes in to be evaluated, and also the conclusion that, for example, burning or cutting a child is never appropriate, and that was the consensus of the work group of how to respond to that. But I certainly note your comment and share some similar concerns, and I think it will have some further discussion in the work group.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my question has to do with, you're talking about reports in multiple counties, and I see number 8 on the recommendation about making it accessible to share information across counties. That's after working for the Anoka County Sheriff's Office for several years. One of the things that we saw with populations that moved frequently between Hennepin County and Anoka County is we would see a family that maybe had developed a history with Hennepin County and then move from Minneapolis into Columbia Heights just across the border, and then basically have reports that start over again, and now a new school district for the child, and it's almost like it kind of defaulted back to square one. I worked a homicide case out of Anoka County with an assault of a child by a live-in boyfriend, and come to find out that there was a huge backlog of information from Hennepin County, and they were about to go into the process of removing the child from the home. However, then the family moved 3 blocks into a new county, and the whole process started over again. So what can the task force do besides, you know, a significant investment in infrastructure around IT to ensure that we're getting a comprehensive view of the child as we're making these placement decisions.
Ms. Zender-Fisher.
Thank you. Without looking at the technology, so for example, I might not know if the family's not honest if I'm going in Anoka County to investigate. If the family's not honest about where they came from, I'm not going to know where to go to call Hennepin County, for example, and ask if they've got history. So I think it's critical to ensure that the IT system is set up to allow for that. I know that the system, and I don't use SSIS, so I'm not as versed with it as others, but I know that the system is set up to allow some of that information to be shared, but we want greater access to more information more readily and immediately so that decisions are made in a timely manner.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, and I understand that. I think the IT component is an important component, but did the task force talk about any type of procedure to hand off a case or a family? If you're working with a family, if you're doing some intervention, and then that family moves, was there talk about a process in place so that if you know the family that's in the system or is being worked with is then moving into another county, that there's a process where Hennepin County calls Anoka County and says, hey, this is our group that we've been working with. They've now moved into your backyard. We were close to doing an incident where we were going to remove the child from that case, from that family. Now they're in your backyard. Is there that type of process in place that should have been followed prior, or has the task force talked about implementing something like that?
Ms. Zender-Fisher.
Thank you. We haven't had that specific conversation. I know my practice has been that if we get a family that's at high risk coming into our county, we generally get a call from another county, and I would look to some guidance from DHS in terms of, I think that there's an obligation 30 days or maybe 60 days, 90 days, something like that, that if the county moves, that the county that had responsibility for that family continues to have a responsibility for that family. So I know that that's in place, whether that's in practice or statute, that I'm not familiar with, but I think it's a good thing to take back to the work group.
And welcome to the committee, Commissioner Jessen. If you want to expound on this topic, that would be helpful.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, I'm Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services, and I just stepped forward hearing the question about, is there a practice in place? Yes, there is a practice in place around this, and I know we have several experienced human services directors here who could talk in more detail about that if the committee or Representative Zerwas want to know more detail about that. And on the IT question, yes, as I think Ms. Zender-Fisher alluded to, we have beefed it up so that a worker can get the authority to go in and look at cases in other counties. But I do think there's more education we can do around that, so we make sure it happens more often. Thank you for recognizing me. I didn't mean to interfere.
Oh, that's very helpful. Thank you, Commissioner. And we have one more question, and then members, just as time is starting to get away from us, we have another testifier, we need to speed it up a little bit. So we'll go to Representative Moran, and then I'll let Ms. Zender-Fisher finish her presentation.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I have I heard you state that, and there have been cases where sexual abuse and some physical abuse had been referred to family assessment. And that I see in your recommendation, you kind of like did some clarity around what is physical abuse. But I was just wondering, how would one know the difference in how to refer family assessment versus family investigation? When a report come in, how would that person know what to do?
Ms. Zender-Fisher.
Thank you. The screening decision is based upon whether there's an allegation of substantial child endangerment. And if it's substantial child endangerment, the way the statute is currently written, it should. If there's not, then it should go to family assessment. If there's substantial child endangerment, it should go then to family investigation. And whether it is substantial child endangerment is dependent upon whether it meets the criminal statutes that are listed in 626-556. And there's, if I'm recalling correctly, it's a very limited number of child abuse or of abuse cases that would constitute substantial child endangerment. It would have to be assault 1, 2, or 3, which at minimum would require substantial harm to the person. So it would be a temporary but protracted disfigurement or a broken bone in order to get to substantial child endangerment for a third degree assault, which would, or if it would meet a malicious punishment standard or child endangerment. So a spanking of a child, depending on age, may get a family assessment response, depending on whether there's injury observed and the age of the child. If there is injury observed, then that may be deemed substantial child endangerment under a malicious punishment. That's where we saw some great disparity in the application of the guidelines and how counties are responding to screening decisions.
Okay.
Representative Moran.
And I would guess, Madam Chair, that had been missed in the past. I mean, those guidelines are clearly there, but it wasn't happening. And so the hope is that you will have some more training, people be a little bit more informed of what that looks like. So you also talk about family first is now going to be disregarded, and it's going to go into the child first. And I'm trying to wrap my head around, because to me that could mean a lot of things, because I look at family first, I look beyond the parents, if they are the cause of the harm, that would be a placement with that child, with a grandparent, an aunt, or something like that, you know, because that is part of the family. So is that, I mean, what do you mean by family first, and it's going to be disregarded? And I understand what you mean, you know, that you're looking to the well-being of the child only, but I'm looking, when that happens, what that placement looks like.
Ms. Edner Fisher.
Thank you. I think, first of all, that the application of whether it should be family assessment or family investigation, I think there was some pretty strict interpretation of what substantial child endangerment was and whether you could disregard if you had a case that appeared very serious. Even if it didn't meet that criteria, there was still the ability to treat something as a family investigation instead of a family assessment. So I think greater training and clarity is needed to ensure that those cases aren't missed. When I talked about family being disregarded, I want to be clear that the work group is not disregarding the importance of family, but to some extent maintaining family and working with families has become the focus over the safety of the child. And by family, I'm talking about looking at that who might be the perpetrator of the maltreatment, generally the parent or maybe the boyfriend. I certainly know that in our work group discussion that when we're looking at placement issues, that family still remains the consideration for placement. If there is a relative that is available to take care of the child, we're not discounting the importance of family for placement decisions, because certainly that is important for the child if there is someone that can take that role.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Ender Fisher, if you want to wrap up your presentation.
I didn't have anything further prepared. If there aren't any other questions, I will turn it to Dr. Hudson.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for answering all the questions, and your presentation is very helpful. Next, we have Dr. Mark Hudson, who's the Executive Director of the Midwest Regional Child Advocacy Center. If you could just introduce yourself and proceed with your presentation.
Sure. My name is Mark Hudson. I am a child abuse pediatrician. I'm the Medical Director of the Midwest Children's Resource Center, which is the child abuse subspecialty clinic at Children's Hospitals and Clinics in Minnesota. I'm on the work group that is charged with looking at the family assessment system as well as some of the resource issues. My thoughts today are that I would like to start a little bit with just a little bit more background, and I may cover some of the ground again that has been covered by the assistant commissioner about how we got here, but I think that there is some importance in that, and talk about some of the things that we have spoken about in our work group. I'd like to then go and talk a little bit about some of the specific recommendations that are coming out of the task force. And I do just want to clarify a little bit. I think the recommendations have all come out of the entire task force, but some of the background discussion in more depth is coming from the work group. So I will likely probably inadvertently talk about recommendations coming out of the work group, but these recommendations that have been presented are actually from the entire task force. As I mentioned, our work group was charged with trying to evaluate the family assessment system. I would like to kind of sit here and define what happens in a family assessment. But quite honestly, we have had great difficulty. We're a couple of months into this. I have heard testimony from many different people, and I'm still not sure that we can define exactly what happens in a family assessment. Because there appears to be great variation. So I would like to start just talking a little bit about kind of how we got here. As mentioned by the assistant commissioner, this was a movement that is part of a national movement, kind of started in Missouri, and was really adopted by Minnesota. And there was a relatively large and one of the early studies about the family assessment or alternative response system that was done in Minnesota starting in about year 2001, wrapping up, I believe, in about 2006. And this is a study that is frequently cited and actually comes up quite frequently when we might hear people refer to the family assessment response in Minnesota being evidence-based. It is often referred back to the study that was done in the early 2000s, and it was done by a group called Institute for Applied Research. At the time, I think it's worth kind of going back to think about what happened in that study. At the time, there was an alternative response system. There was some screening criteria. At the time in Minnesota of the study, about 40% of the children who entered the family assessment system or entered the child protection system were considered to be appropriate for a family assessment or an alternative response. There was about 20 counties involved in this original study. They were the families were split into two different groups. One group did receive significant money from the McKnight Foundation. The Family Assessment Response received a significant amount of influx of money to work on training, more services, etc. There was no money put to the investigative or the traditional response. Children were followed, and indeed, at the end of the study, there was a slight difference in the re-report rate. So about at the end of about an average follow-up period of about 3.5 years, the re-report rate for the assessment arm was about 2% lower. So not significantly different, but there was indeed a difference. Now, this study has been quite significantly criticized. There are certainly some things that may be questionable. The re-report rate during the case time when a case was open was higher in the assessment group than in the investigation group, but that was discounted. So a number of issues there. So I think from a little bit of a background from the work group, I'm not sure we support a statement that says our family assessment response is evidence-based. And I think that's kind of a little bit of background on that. As mentioned already, the family assessment response did become the preferred response, and it was supposed to be used in any case. Well, I should say the investigative response was mandated in any case that alleged substantial child endangerment. And there's about 13 definitions ranging from egregious harm, malicious punishment, sexual abuse, etc. And over the years, really our use of the family assessment system has really grown to the point where now currently over 70% of the reports, as noted in the graphs earlier, over 70% of the reports come in and are assigned to a family assessment response. If we look specifically at neglect, about 76% of the cases get a family assessment response. physical abuse were around 79% of the cases get a family assessment response. So I said we've had some difficulty defining what a family assessment response is. And I look, I just have to go back to at least what sort of seems to be some of the foundation, at least at the onset of when the family assessment started. Family assessments started as a response to low-risk cases where there were not significant safety concerns. Currently, approximately about 28% of the cases that are in the family assessment response are considered high-risk cases, versus about 50% of the cases in the traditional response are considered high-risk cases. Originally, the idea behind, or one of the foundations of the family assessment response has been mentioned already, is that services were to be voluntary. Okay, and that has generally continued. So currently we're in a system where in the family assessment response, about 30% of the kids are considered high risk for ongoing abuse. About 17% get a mandate to have ongoing services. Contrast that to the traditional response, where approximately 50% of the kids are high risk and approximately 50% of the kids get mandated services. In the family assessment response, there is about another 13% of the families that are offered services, though it is unclear whether they are, those services are used or not. There's been some discussion about this flow chart that has been presented, and certainly some of our recommendations are aimed at some parts of this flow chart, and specifically as it relates to this service provision. Certainly, there. What we're finding is there is great variation in what happens when services are offered within, well, either arm, but particularly within the family assessment. Some counties report that they are, in fact, consulting with their child protection attorneys and filing CHIPS petitions when services are refused and it is a high-risk case. Sometimes that seems as though that is not happening. So there seems to be pretty significant variation in what actually happens in the area of service provision. Another component of the family assessment response that seems to be sort of one of the legs of the stool is that there is no finding of maltreatment in the child in the family assessment response. So we are hearing great variation in what that means when it comes to implementation on the ground. Certainly, the family assessment philosophy is meant to be non-investigatory. Tough word for me, sorry. It is meant not to be aimed at finding out necessarily if abuse happened or not. And we have heard from people providing testimony that there seems to be relatively great variation, with some counties saying, we indeed try to find out if a child was maltreated or not, we just don't make a finding. And other counties saying, no, we don't try to find out if a child was maltreatment, if a child was maltreated or not, we don't try to find those facts because that is considered confrontational. Some of the underlying principles are that the family assessment response is supposed to be focused on family strengths, and that's there seems to be variation in what that means. Sometimes that means we will work on the strengths of the family after we find out what has or hasn't happened. Sometimes that means that finding out what may or may not have happened is considered to be non-strength-based, and so it's not done. So we have seen great variation around what we're hearing in our work group, and some of the some of our people providing testimony have really said it's exactly the same, less the finding of maltreatment. Some have said it is vastly different, and some seem to say both at the same time. So we have struggled a bit to know what that means. I mentioned earlier, and when we talk about the research that is often cited to back this up, there was a slight decrease in the family assessment, the re-report rate in the family assessment response versus the investigative response. Last year, the investigative response, the re-report rate was about 2% lower than for the assessment response. And this has been true that the traditional response has had a lower re-report rate in 5 out of the last 7 years. So the seems that some of the promises we were given based upon the study have not necessarily come to fruition, at least as it relates to the re-report rate. With that, I think I'd like to go to talking a little bit about some of the recommendations specifically. As the previous speaker did, I have broken those up a bit into some broad categories, but I will also reference some of the specific recommendations made by the task force. The recommendations related to family assessment really start with recommendation 17, and we have made a recommendation out of the task force that we eliminate the family assessment response as the preferred response and go to a system again that really looks at a response that is based more on the presentation and less on trying to push into one track versus another. Recommendations 18 and 19 are very much about sort of more involvement of the county attorney system and looking at what happens when services are deemed to be necessary. Again, sort of going back to the flowchart that is actually still up on the board behind me, the flowchart really shows that when child protection services are needed, that there's a consultation with the county or tribal attorney, and in reality, that is not something that happens. That may be, in some cases, something that happens when services are refused. In some cases, it may certainly not be something that happens. So our recommendation around that is more involvement of the county attorney in those decisions, particularly as it relates to service provision. Recommendation 20 and 21 really are around the idea of fact-finding and around the idea of what information should child protection attempt to gather when they encounter a case of potential maltreatment. We do believe, as a task force, that comprehensive fact-finding is important. I will say there remains much contention about what those facts that should be gathered are. Should that be whether the child was maltreated or not, or should we not expect that there is any fact-finding around whether a child has suffered maltreatment or not? That is a recommendation that I think we'll be making more recommendations about as we move forward. Number 21, again, speaks a bit to the fact-finding. Currently in the family assessment model, it is often encourage that that children be interviewed in the presence of their parents, and we as a task force are making recommendation that children really should be interviewed individually in an attempt to try to gather that information. Some of the rationale behind that certainly is that when we think of domestic violence, whether that any other form of domestic violence, we really don't expect that a victim be interviewed in the presence of a potential perpetrator. And that has been some of the testimony that has led to that recommendation. Recommendation 23, we're very interested in looking at more trauma-informed care and really looking at what that trauma means for the child and what kind of services can be put in place to address the trauma that the child has suffered. And that trauma, quite honestly, may be the trauma of the abuse, the neglect, the maltreatment. That may be the trauma of involvement with the system. That may be trauma of placement at times. Okay. Item number 24, recommendation 24, the task force would really like to see us move towards doing more outcome measures. We'd like to be focused on child-centric measures and measures that address potential trauma symptomatology in children who are in the child protection system. Item number 25, we do know that the more we learn about trauma effects on children, we also know that there are protective factors that can be strengthened within children to help them come out of the system or out of a trauma system with a better outcome. We do recommend that we explore more around some of the protective factors and ways to enhance protective factors within children. Currently, item number 26, or recommendation number 26, there is a set of tools called the structured decision making that is often employed in the child protection response. And there are structured tools to look at both safety as well as ongoing risk. We would like to see the department move towards looking more at those tools and looking specifically at some of the factors that may predict what someone will call dangerousness. Some of those factors may be young age of children, past history, things like that, and move those more into the structured decision-making process. Item number 27, or recommendation number 27, I think there's still some debate about what our final system should look like in an ideal world as far as whether there should or shouldn't even be two tracks, with a family assessment track, or if we should think of a system that melds the strengths of both. But in any event, if we are to remain with a two-track system, we'd like to look at some more screening and track assignment tools so that there is more objectivity that is placed into that track assignment, decision, and this maybe speaks a bit to the question by Representative Albright from Kurt earlier. And item number 28, we would like to see more involvement of a multidisciplinary team in the family assessment track. We do know that oftentimes involvement of more professionals can lead to a better outcome than children who are assessed within a silo.
Representative Moran, if you have a brief question, we have to wrap up here. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I want to go back to the protective factors, and you stated that, you know, here one of the recommendations was to do some research on protective factors for the child, and I was just wondering some clarity in order to protect the child from children from harm. My thought would be the protective factor would be with the family, with the parents. So I was wondering, was there any conversation of how you can support the needs of the parents to ensure that they are keeping the kids safe at home using protective factors?
Well,
Dr. Hudson.
Madam Chair, excuse me. I think that there are, in this particular discussion, was more around protective factors in the child. Certainly there are many factors that lead to a child's protection, some of them being family factors, some of them being innate factors to the child. And certainly when we think about poor outcomes associated with maltreatment, whether that be long-term psychiatric harm, long-term physical harm, poor social functioning, we know that children who have certain protective factors, and sometimes those protective factors are a connection with other caring adults, sometimes that is within the family, sometimes that is without the family, and we know that can lead to some improved outcomes. And so that conversation was really a child-focused conversation.
Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Hudson, for your presentation. And I know, I believe we have your guys' information if members have follow-up questions about some of the specific recommendations. Just before we wrap up, I wanted to just, Commissioner Tony Carter is here, who was the co-chair. If you want to just come forward briefly, as well as Commissioner Jessen, they were co-chairs of this task force. Thank you, Dr. Hudson. If you guys have any just comments or anything you want to leave with the committee, and then members, obviously there's a lot here. We're taking up Representative Kreisch's bill tomorrow that addresses many of these recommendations, and we'll have many testifiers tomorrow as well for further questions. But to the commissioners, if you have anything that you think was left out you'd like to leave with the committee, we are all ears.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members. I'll just say a few quick things about what you can, where we are, and what you can expect to hear from the task force moving forward. As you can tell, we really are taking a broad, fresh look at our child protection system, which is very much called for. And so, thank you all for diving into this afternoon. As you can hear and look at this, we have come to a consensus, and actually, an overwhelming majority of the task force, all the members, actually supported these initial recommendations, which I just am very much supportive of. But we have a lot of work ahead of us, and as you can tell from hearing this testimony, there are a lot of issues we're going to be struggling with. Let me just highlight a few of them over the next few months. One, certainly the role of family assessment in our child protection system. I think that's probably come across from the questions and the answers you've heard today is something that we're saying it shouldn't, the task force recommends it shouldn't be the preferred course, but what role it plays I think is something we will continue to look at. Transparency is a big one that we'll just be diving in. That doesn't mean that just because a family's reported on that their names and all their family members are going to become public, but we need to bring more ongoing transparency to this system. We need to address the disparities within the system and make sure that we have more racial and cultural competence in our policy and our practice. And we've gotten some good recommendations from groups out around that, and we'll be discussing that. More specifics on training and supervision, and finally on resources. We have a county-state work group that's looking at these recommendations and saying if they go into place, then what resources would it take? And that's starting out as well. I would just say from the DHS perspective, we're also bringing a lot of fresh faces to this. I think I apologize for being late coming, but you got to hear from our new Assistant Commissioner, Jim Koppel. We have, as of last April, a new director at our Child Safety and Permanency Division. And you note, if you look at your chart, which I thank our staff for doing such a good job putting this together, a lot of these things don't require law changes. They require changes at the department level and some of the county level. And even by the end of this month, we'll be putting out a fresh bulletin, which incorporates into our practice a number of the changes recommended by the task force. So thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Commissioner Jessen. Commissioner Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I'd also like to say thank you to the members from the task force who have come forward today and to Governor Dayton and Commissioner Cindy Jessen for this opportunity to co-chair this task force. As a county commissioner and also as recent past president of the Association of Minnesota Counties, I know that you know this is very, very important to counties and to our tribal governance systems as well. This is a place where counties place a large amount of our effort and resource, as you have heard. So we are welcoming this opportunity to look very, very carefully at our child protection system, at what we know it is, its strengths, as well as its needs, and to ensure that we are doing our very best to keep children safe. The team has placed a lot of effort around this since having been appointed in October by the governor, and the focus clearly is child safety first, and at the same time, the ability to strengthen families so that we have better outcomes overall for our children. A lot of the discussion in putting those 32 recommendations that you have forward has been around just that, and the remaining discussion, of course, includes that perspective as we move forward. So we look forward to the additional recommendations that we will be making for you. Thank you for your serious consideration. The commissioners already talked about the remaining work and the dates by which you should expect additional information from us. I thank you very much and remain at your available to you for any questions or discussions you would like to have. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you for taking the time to be here. Members, we'll continue this discussion tomorrow as we hear Representative Kreisha's bill. And also, members, I just wanted to draw your attention. I was going to do it at the beginning, but we were a little sparse with members. In your save folder is the committee rules. And so they were emailed out to you last week also, but there's a hard copy. They're very similar to what they have been in the past for this committee. The one thing I'll just draw your attention to is members that aren't here will be marked as excused. So just want to draw your attention to that, as well as just pay attention to regarding the amendments being submitted to committee 24 hours in advance of the bill being heard in committee. So if there are any questions, we can certainly take those, or you can contact me at any time. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We don't yet know what the permanent rules of the House are going to look like and whether there's going to be a 24-hour rule there. And I would just ask you, if the majority now decides to keep that rule, which I hope they don't, whether this committee would be removing the 24-hour requirement for amendments.
If that is the decision of the House, we would certainly consider it, and we'll take that up when that decision is made by the larger body. Thank you, Representative Liebling. So if there are any other questions, you can feel free to ask or catch me offline for clarity. But with that, we are adjourned, members.